Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I am Leonard Lopate. In the debate over immigration at the Mexican border, often overlooked or marginalized is the fact that the Hispanic past of the United States predates the arrival of the Pilgrims by a century and has been every bit as important in shaping the nation as it exists today and the cultural issues that have continued to be unresolved: language, belonging, community, race, and nationality. In her latest book, El Norte, The Epic and Forgotten Story of Hispanic North America, historian Carrie Gibson offers a correction to the mostly neglected but important role of Spanish pioneers and Native Americans to American history in favor of settlers from England, Ireland, and Scotland. Her book is published by Atlantic Monthly Press, and it brings Carrie Gibson to our show now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Is this a logical follow-up to your previous book, Empire's Crossroads, A History of the Caribbean from Columbus to the Present Day?
There is an element of overlap in it, because certainly in El Norte, I talk a lot about Puerto Rico and Cuba. They are both quite big narrative histories that start in the 15th century and go forward. So in that way, there is definitely a connection, and there's definitely points of overlap for sure. I mean, I have to start El Norte talking about Columbus, and you know, in a very similar way that I have to with Empire's Crossroads.
Well, you sure had a long story to tell. This book is 437 pages, although there are some illustrations in the middle. You cover American history from early Spanish colonies in Florida and the founding of Louisiana to the battle between the U.S. and Mexico over Texas and Hispanic settlements in California. When did it all begin? Was it, Columbus never came to the mainland.
No, I mean, really, if anything, it starts with Hernan Cortes and his encounter in Mexico, and it becomes very much a bit of a race to see what other riches are out there. Even before that, certainly after, you get Ponce de Leon going to Florida. There's this sense of that there are these other places of wealth outside of Hispaniola. So
and
first, you know, you
go ahead. Mm-hmm. Finish what you're going to say.
First, you have the Spaniards on Hispaniola, and from there they branch out.
Could you turn your radio down, because we're hearing that in the background as well?
There's no radio. There's no radio on.
We're getting some odd other sound, but okay. In the case of Florida, the visit there was before Cortez actually. Before the Spanish took over Mesoamerica, Ponce de Leon he arrived in 1513. Was he really searching for the Fountain of Youth?
No. they think that, I mean, partly it was just exploratory, but then there's also some thinking that he was going on slaving missions. The indigenous populations in Hispaniola and the other islands were, you know, rapidly dying because of disease and overwork. And they were looking to others to find other sources of people to bring back and enslave as well. So that was definitely part of what he was doing on the first mission.
Although it's only 21 years after Columbus winds up in the Americas. You point out, because of our shared English language and the origin tales that we were taught in our history classes of Jamestown and the Mayflower and of the rebellion of the British colonies, the U.S. has prized its Anglo heritage above all others. How much do we miss if we ignore the other parts of our history that you've written about in this book?
We miss quite a lot, really, because there's this kind of longer, messier story that predates the arrival of the Mayflower. So, you know, and I talk about this in Empire's Crossroads as well. You've kind of got a lot of this sort of 16th century expansion, European expansion into the Caribbean. You have a lot of rivalries. And you do have Spain and the Spanish Empire expanding and claiming a lot of what it finds, you know, which ends up being most of sort of South America, Central America, and its attempts to colonize North America. Their failure to get a foothold in the East Coast and their willingness to eventually allow British settlement, or actually not so much allow it, but they're unable to stop it, and this happens in the Caribbean as well, is you know, gives the well at that time the English a way to get their own foothold, and because those colonies, the 13 colonies, became quite prosperous, and you know, that kind of became a dominant story. But there was so much more going on in the century, you know, before that, basically. And I think sometimes that gets eclipsed. But also, it means that we lose our connection to this larger sort of Latin American history. You know, that become the connection between United States and the rest of the hemisphere becomes much, much clearer when we go back to this point and we see all these kind of historical actors together on the same stage, or at least fighting over, or, you know, showing up a little bit after or a bit before each other. And you get much more of a sense that the development of the United States is connected to how European imperial expansion happened across the hemisphere.
Didn't some American writers of the past comment on this? You quote Walt Whitman, who never ceases to surprise me, and he wrote in 1883 that Americans long ago tacitly abandoned themselves to, quote, the notion that our United States have been fashioned from the British Islands, which is a great mistake. And he added, to that composite American identity of the future, Spanish character will supply some of the most needed parts.
Yeah, I was really intrigued by this letter by Whitman, because he wrote it to turn down an offer to speak at an anniversary of the founding of Santa Fe. But I think certainly in the 19th century, there was still an awareness of this history, but the fact that it surfaces here, I found really, really interesting, because one of the other things that developed alongside Spanish imperial expansion is this idea of the Black legend. And the Black legend kind of positions the Spaniards as these very bloodthirsty, horrible conquistadors who commit all these atrocities. But every other European group that comes to the Americas does the same thing. But it's very connected to the Spaniards' Catholicism. It, you know, this narrative emerges as Europe is kind of riven with Protestant and Catholic fighting each other. You have the Reformation. So in the middle of all this kind of comes this narrative that positions the Spaniards in this quite dark way, hence the name the Black Legend. But what happens is that seeps into kind of consciousness of all the other groups, especially groups that are Protestant groups that come over to the New World. So that would end up being the English, that ends up being the Dutch. Stories of Spanish atrocities get printed and circulated throughout Europe as they become known. So there's, in some ways, there was always a kind of knowledge that the Spanish were there, but it was very much couched in these particular terms as well. So, and that was very much part of the lore around the Spanish encounter in the Americas. So, yeah, but seeing Whitman and seeing that letter kind of comes at a really, really interesting moment. And that's part of the reason I really wanted to include it in the book and put it in such a central place.
But even 36 years earlier, in 1847, before Whitman wrote that, during the Mexican-American War, the American Review said, Mexico was poor, distracted, in anarchy, and almost in ruins, and it asked, what could she do to impede the march of our greatness? We are Anglo-Saxon Americans. It was our destiny to possess and to rule this continent. We were a chosen people, and this was our allotted inheritance, and we must drive out all other nations. Is this part of the concept of manifest destiny and acquisitiveness that that conceived Anglo-European privilege and drove much of the history of the 19th century?
Oh, without question. And I'm sure, you know, reflecting on the Mexican-American War also comes into Whitman and his thoughts. But that particular quote is is supposed to be kind of a parody of the type of sort of discourse that was around at the time. Because, you know, it kind of puts, in that one succinct sort of paragraph, it kind of puts so many of the ways, the stereotypes of Manifest Destiny. But, I mean, that was certainly the case. If you look at 19th century newspapers, even just the sort of enthusiasm with which people went to war during the Mexican-American War initially, you can definitely see that there was a very much a belief that the continent should spread. And, I mean, James K. Polk campaigned on this very successfully because he also had the Oregon question. So, you know, it wasn't just expanding into then what was Mexico. It was also about expanding, you know, even further to the north as well.
Hadn't the gringos, if for want of a better word, been invited into much of that Mexican territory, been allowed to have land, and then turned around and fought against the Mexicans using the excuse of an autocratic president?
Well, yeah. I mean, I take it you're referring to the sort of Texas incident.
Yes. Well, I've been to the Alamo, and it's amazing the story they tell. You'd think that that the poor Texans were total victims in this story.
Well, it is very interesting. When I was at the Alamo, because I obviously went there as well, I was really struck at how little mention was given to the issue of slavery, which was the key issue in all of this. So when Moses Austin, Stephen Austin's father originally, went to look for new opportunities. His initial deal was with the Spanish, and it was right around the time of the Mexican independence. And so Mexico decided to honor his agreement, and he died very soon anyway, and his son, Stephen Austin, went down there and brought settlers, because there had never been many Mexican, European Spaniards living in that part, and there were a lot of attacks from Native Americans. So there was an interest in keeping it very, very populated. So they kind of let him start, and then obviously they worked out that this part of Texas was good for growing cotton, and people started to bring slaves. Well, as Mexico develops into a republic, one of the things it's very keen to do is end the slave trade, end enslavement of human beings, and this does not go down well with that particular band of settlers. But yes, they were invited, they were given land, and for a few years, there were quite a few attempts to bring on gradual manumission, to come to some sort of agreement about this, and then it breaks down, and you know, eventually you get Texas independent. And it does. It's been very striking how much of the story around that has left out slavery. I mean, more recent scholarship, of course, has re-examine this completely, but going to sort of public sites and not seeing the issue of slavery front and center was quite surprising to me, actually. There's definitely quite a complicated history over that period, really, between sort of 1820 and the end of the Mexican-American War. And again, we can see this kind of snowballing into expansion as well.
But even into modern times, you cite some really shocking examples of racism in this country. In 1878, when he described the planned freeze that was to ring the U.S. Capitol's dome, the building engineer Montgomery Meigs said it would depict, quote, the gradual progress of the continent from the depths of barbarism to the heights of civilization, the gradual advance of the white and the retreat of the red races. And then even in our century, Blanton Winship, the appointed governor of Puerto Rico from 1934 to 39, said the Puerto Rican population was unable to govern itself because, quote, they could not supply the brains, character, and other equipment necessary for carrying on the government of their territory. Sounds kind of familiar. Are you surprised that many people in this country are unaware that Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens?
No, I'm not. It's unfortunate, and I didn't realize the extent of that until Hurricane Maria, and then it became. I think there was a poll right after that said that, you know, only around 50% of polled people, you know, 50% of the country, understood that Puerto Rico's relationship and why we should be helping them after the hurricane. There's always been an uncomfortableness with equating United States identity with being an empire. But, you know, certainly if you look at the Mexican-American War, I mean, if that's not an imperial war, what is it? I mean, the U.S. gets at the end of it 51% of Mexico. You know, again, after the Spanish-American War, we get Puerto Rico, and the U.S. only escapes just getting Cuba. Quite a lot of people really, really had their eyes on Cuba. And, of course, there's the whole issue of the Philippines as well. But there's always been this kind of reluctance to admit that. But when you look at the treatment and U.S. policy and actions towards our Hispanic neighbors, then, you know, you can definitely see a pattern. The other thing, too, is just to go back to the idea of the Black legend, is that it also came with it this idea that these Catholic Spaniards who intermarry with Native Americans, you know, this mestizo population. None of these people are fit to govern. Like this is very much again a kind of trope that emerges. So even as early as someone like Jefferson, I think he said something along the lines of, you know, you can't really trust places run by a bunch of Catholics. Something to that extent. I'd have to go back and look at the actual quote. So there's this suspicion almost from the beginning of Latin, you know, Latin American independence, you know, starting around 1810, and the development of the republic, throughout the hemisphere, there's already kind of a suspicion there that these people can't govern like we can.
I want to quote somebody else along those lines, but first remind our listeners that my guest on Leonard Lopate at Large today is Carrie Gibson, whose latest book is El Norte, The Epic and Forgotten Story of Hispanic North America. More recently, not long before he died in 2006, didn't the noted political historian Samuel Huntington write that America was, I'm quoting, was created by settlers who were overwhelmingly white, British, and Protestant, and therefore the arrival of Hispanics in large numbers remained a direct threat. He said that those immigrants had dual nationalities and dual loyalties because of their Spanish language and Catholic religion.
Right, and that very much tapped into this long-running anxiety about that difference. But I find his view quite problematic, as I write about in the book, partly because it shuts out that largest history of the continent. You know, because we do have a shared history and we share the legacy of European colonialism from whichever country, be it Britain or Spain, it's surprising that we're all actually not bilingual in some ways, you know, that we all don't have a more fluid kind of sense of our relations to each other. And I found his work particularly unhelpful in trying to draw these really strict lines that actually in some ways don't reflect how we live now or how we lived 20 years ago when 15 years ago when he wrote that. So but I think we still struggle with this idea that Hispanic people are the other. When actually, you know, if we look at the whole hemisphere's story, we're all kind of in it together.
And you write, what does it mean to be Hispanic? Is one Hispanic if one does not speak Spanish or Portuguese? Or does ethnicity extend beyond the borders of language? You ask, what point are you allowed to not be Hispanic?
I mean, that's, to me, this is one of the hardest things to write about and one of the most interesting at the same time. I don't have a Hispanic background, so I'm coming at it as a complete outsider.
You're a Georgian who lives in London.
In London, that's right. I have an immigrant background in that my grandmother and my grandparents immigrated from Italy after the Second World War. So in some ways, I know what it's like to have relatives who don't speak English and that sort of thing. But I'm not, you know, where I sit doesn't sit in that debate. But certainly when you work on Latin America and the United States and the Caribbean, these questions of identity are very much bound up with the historian's job. You know, we have to think about this. And there's so many debates. There's debates about language. You know, do we say Latino? Do we say Latinx? Do we say Hispanic? Language is really interesting. There was I cite a Pew poll at one point in the book that says that, you know, something like 70% of people polled didn't think you needed to speak Spanish to be Latino. So there's all these different layers of what that identity means. And you know, when you think about people who live in the part of the U.S. that became the U.S. after the Mexican-American War, so, you know, California, New Mexico, Arizona, whose families go back these many, many generations. I mean, again, like, what does that mean in terms of identity compared with somebody who has just entered the U.S. a couple of years ago? So, I have no definitive answer, but I think it's important to put these things out there and discuss the nuances. The problem is when we try to draw this character of the Hispanic, and the reality is there isn't one. There's people from all over, and each Latin American country is very different as well. And one of the things about the concept of Hispanic and that identity that I found so interesting is that especially the idea of Latino is something that was formed in the U.S. So if you're a Cuban and you move to England, you're a Cuban. People don't call you a Latino. But if you go to the U.S., they might very well call you a Latino, or that's something you'll tick in a census or, you know, on these people's paperwork. So the formation of that identity is fascinating.
I was interested in your discussion of how the culture has been colored by whatever word we want to use here. Hispanic-rooted music has been popular in this country since the 1920s. There were many Hispanic-tinged films and starlets of the 30s and 40s and on TV in the 50s, Lucy and Desi and also Zorro and the Cisco Kid. And when I was in high school, Xavier Cugat and Perez Prado were quite popular. Everyone in my school was serious about learning how to do the mambo. When I was growing up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, the local movie house regularly showed Cantinflas comedies from Mexico for all the Spanish speakers in the neighborhood. They were Puerto Ricans, but the humor was international in a way. And Hispanic sports stars have been a major part, especially of baseball. So. Why are we even having this discussion?
I know, and I think that's one of the reasons that I was drawn to thinking about this topic, because, you know, I've been out of the country a long time, and when I was back for the 2012 election around that time, and I was just really surprised at the discourse. I was really surprised at the things that people were saying, and I just thought, why are we having this conversation when clearly this is so much part of the fabric of American life. But there's clearly a need to. And we're seeing that come around again as well, especially in terms of how we talk about the border and border security and immigration. So when I started, and I had to leave so much out of this book as well. But when I started compiling, especially things in popular culture, it's absolutely part of modern U.S. culture. All the different elements that come to it. You know, music from Cuba, food from Mexico. There's so many things.
Yes, Americans consider tacos, I guess, American food, U.S. food. In fact, there are Taco Bells in Mexico, and they call that American food. You mentioned that the racism wasn't one-sided. Can we say that the racism in the Americas began with Columbus? The Spanish historian Consuelo Varela wrote that Columbus stopped the baptism of the Arawak people, the Taínos, as Christians so that he could sell them as slaves. And didn't he even get a percentage from the first bordello in America?
I mean, yeah, I mean, the, eventually the Crown had to step in and sort of try to protect the indigenous people. But ideas that we have about race, ideas that we have about color, in almost a very sort of basic sense, a lot of this stuff comes out of that colonial encounter and how Europeans used it and built a system of exploitation on it, really, in many ways, of course. But it starts with Columbus and then you follow the line and it's where we are today. But that's, this is not unique to the United States. I mean, one of the things that always surprises me when I'm in Mexico is that everybody in an advert looks sort of European. There's nobody that looks indigenous. Like, casual racism, and even in Spain, for instance.
Have you seen Roma, the film Roma?
I haven't yet. It's high on my list.
You will find it fascinating. It's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. So within Latin America, I spend a lot of time in Cuba. And Cuba officially, has tried to prohibit racism. And the revolution has tried to be very firm in that. But you undo all this. It takes a long time to undo all the systematic racisms that are in place. So, a lot of the poorest Cubans are also, Afro-Cubans, and a lot of the lighter-skinned Cubans are the more privileged ones. So you see this across Latin America. And again, that's what I mean about our kind of shared history is also our shared problems.
Well, your book is not just about Hispanics in America. You write about the great diversity of Native American culture before the arrival of all Europeans. You said there were probably 300,000 Native Americans in Alta California alone before the Spaniards arrived, speaking 90 languages. And you quote a priest in San Diego who wrote in 1772 that Spanish troops deserve to be hanged on account of the continuous outrages which they are committing in seizing and raping the women. So this is really, to some degree, a European racist story as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it wasn't just the British or just the Spanish or just the French. It was everybody, because all of a sudden, all these things were at play at the same time. Power, the search for means of wealth, bringing in the plantation complex, importing enslaved people. So all of these things we have in common. But a whole other world was lost at some level. I mean, some of it persisted. And one of the things that's really interesting is kind of more recent work that's been coming out of the Caribbean, trying to put together some of the Taino past and looking at certain cultural things that have managed to survive despite the fact that so many people died. And we have it linguistically, like words like huracan, hurricane, comes from Arawak and things like that. So there are still things that connect us to that past, but it took a battering, really. I mean, the indigenous world that existed, most people in it, in the Americas, had a pretty heavy assault, and we haven't really reckoned with that in many ways either. I mean, there's so many levels of things that have been problematic and horrifying, and one of them is just that the initial encounters.
Historian Carrie Gibson is my guest today. We are back with Carrie Gibson, whose latest book is El Norte, the epic and forgotten story of Hispanic North America, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. How much of what is continental U.S. Was originally Spanish or Mexican territory?
In theory, the Spanish tried to claim sort of everything. This is kind of before the maps get a bit more specific. So, for instance, for a long time, it was thought that California was an island. The Spanish,
and it still is to some degree.
Yes, depending on your perspective. The Spanish, are quite late, actually, in placing settlements there. And they're doing it in the 1770s at the same time that 13 colonies are trying to break away from Britain. So you kind of have these two sort of flows. And they're spurred into it by reports of sort of Russian ships showing up in the north. And briefly, there's a little political fracas surrounding Nootka Sound, which is in Victoria Island in British Columbia. And that was kind of the furthest that Spain tried to claim. And they almost went to war with Britain over it in the late 1790s. So California is quite late, but that probably the Nootka Sound in California are kind of the upper reaches of Spain, and then after Mexican independence, you still have California, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico. So that great chunk of the West, you know, that we think of as the West, was all part of New Spain, what the Spaniards called New Spain, and then Mexico.
Although President Thomas Jefferson purchased the Louisiana Territory from France in 1803, hadn't it been Spanish territory until 1800, just 3 years earlier?
That's right.
How did that happen? Didn't Napoleon agree when France took it over not to give that territory up?
That's right. So what happened was Spain comes into Louisiana during the Seven Years' War because France wants to make sure that Britain doesn't get its hands on it. And because France and Spain have a pact with Emile, because they've got Bourbons on the throne, Bourbon family relations, they managed to give this to Spain. And Spain administers it. Like, you do see Spanish administrators coming to New Orleans, but the Spanish don't really settle it. So in theory, yes, the whole Louisiana territory is claimed by Spain as well. But really, the people who live there are Native Americans and some French trappers and various very small French settlements. But it's mostly still Native Americans, with most of the activity being in New Orleans. I mean, New Orleans is seen as, you know, quite advantageous for trade and for defense and that sort of thing. But yes, Napoleon convinces Spain to give it back to him on the promise that he won't turn around and sell it. But Napoleon had he'd taken a complete beating in Saint-Domingue as that island's people not only freed themselves from slavery, but also kicked him out and established the nation of Haiti. So he was in a lot of trouble and needed money, and this deal came up. So there was a little bit of double crossing, I think, involving Napoleon and Spain. And Spain at this point still holds on to Spanish Florida. So what had been kind of a connected area, all of a sudden, they have New Spain, Mexico, and they have Florida, and then they've got the U.S. in the middle, and they start to get quite worried about this young country, this ambitious country, you know, this land-hungry country. Almost immediately, there's all kinds of disagreement about rights on using the Mississippi with Spain, and there's all kinds of sort of territorial disagreements and that sort of thing that don't get really ironed out until Florida is given over to the United States in the Adams and the Onis Treaty of 1819. So, Spain starts to get very worried after the Louisiana Purchase.
So was pretty much all of continental U.S., other than the original colonies, Spanish territory at one point or another?
More or less. Some of the sort of northern bits of the U.S. now, like around Michigan and stuff, were claimed as part of sort of French, by the French for a while and things like that. But the thing is, you know, on a map, Spain claimed it, but they didn't settle it in quite the same way that they settled places like, certainly parts of Mexico, in part because Native American resistance was quite fierce. And also, you know, they didn't know if there was going to be gold. The Spanish also didn't bring the same model of plantation society that the British did on the East Coast. And also it's different types of land and it's different types of things. They just couldn't get the settlers, really. And at one point, the Spanish start sort of thinking maybe we'll let some Protestants in because we just don't have anyone living in these parts. And so this is part of the reason you get the Cajuns in Louisiana, is that while Louisiana was under Spanish control, after Britain takes control of that part of Canada, people left, and because they were Catholic, the Spaniards said, sure, come to Louisiana. So that's part of, you know, where that sort of story comes from. So even though there wasn't an enormous presence of Spaniards, you know, them being the administrators of this territory still had, you know, ramifications that are around today.
Did the Spanish prefer the Mesoamerica because it was already civilized, in fact, in some ways more civilized than Europe, when Tenochtitlan, which is now Mexico City, had a population of 150,000, far larger than any European city when the conquistadors came. And Hernan Cortes reported there in 1519 that he could not describe 1/100 of all the things which could be mentioned, including a market where more than 60,000 people come each day to buy and sell, and where every kind of merchandise is found, provisions as well as ornaments of gold and silver, lead, brass, copper, tin, stones, shells, bones, and feathers. And then when he met Emperor Montezuma, Cortes was taken to what he described as a vast compound of palaces, apartments, libraries, warehouses, and even a zoo. So they were, at the same time that they were interested in converting these people and taking it over, they were also in a bit of awe?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and when you look at it and you think about the chutzpah involved with Cortes, I mean, but he also built up enormous alliances. Like, this is not something a plucky band of men did together. He built, you know, he built alliances as he went around parts of Mexico, finding out who was unhappy under the rule of Montezuma and going about it that way. But certainly, yes, when they went into what is today, you know, Mexico City, it was a big metropolis. And in some ways that was familiar to them because Spain was fairly urbanized. As well, it had quite a few cities, nothing on that scale, but it was familiar, but also enormous and grand at the same time. And there just simply wasn't anything further north that was similar. Obviously, going south, it's a different story because, you know, Pizarro runs into, you know, encounters the Inca, and again, a very sort of a civilization that they could find, or a people that they could find a lot in common with in some ways. Certainly, I think Tenochtitlan blew their mind, you know, without question. So I think that's part of the reason, too, why so much settlement stayed in New Spain. I mean, New Spain took a big proportion of Spanish immigrants over time, as did Peru, where places like Cuba was far, far later. And actually, by the time people start immigrating to Cuba in the 19th century, it's not just Spaniards; it's lots of other people. So,
your first chapter is a history of Parris Island, South Carolina. Most people know it as the Marine Corps Training Center. Why begin there?
Because this is kind of a very early site of actual sort of contest, really. It's where the Spanish claim it, but the French show up. And you know, and this is happening in the 1560s. And this is, you know, this is happening well before the sort of Mayflower or anything like that. And this is kind of almost the site. It's that bit of the Atlantic coast that, you know, where Europeans sort of start their foothold, and this is where they really have quite in-depth encounters with Native Americans. You know, forts are built, small settlements are built, and this is all in the 1550s, 1560s. So I thought it was really important to start there. And also, no one thinks of South Carolina as, like, having that kind of particular connection to that early European imperialism. So I wanted to start the book there because it was slightly a counterintuitive start. But, you know, actually, in the sense of chronology, it is one of the earliest parts to start the story, right, places to start the story.
So were the French and the Spaniards allies at this point, or were they fighting over things? Because they both, as I learned from your book, played a role in supporting the American Revolution.
Right, but that comes a bit later. And what the French that come over in the 16th century are Huguenots. So you get the Catholic Protestant fault line. And also at this point, you know, Spain is still kind of struggling to keep all of this to itself. You know, by the 1560s, people know that there's gold in the New World. You know, they know there's land. They know there's all this stuff going on. And Spain tries to keep everyone out. So the idea that these Protestant French are fleeing and they, you know, they come over to South Carolina and intend to put a settlement up, you know, angers them just because, as far as the official mind is concerned, that it's Spain's. It's not their right to do that. So, but obviously, you know, when we go forward to the American Revolution, you know, both countries had an interest in seeing Britain defeated. Spain comes into it a bit later than the French, but behind the scenes, and I thought this was interesting, and I wrote a bit about it in the book, there's a lot of money being funneled through merchant networks. And Spain gives a lot of material support to the rebels, you know, in helping this American independence. At the same time, you get military support coming up from the Caribbean, and you get people like Galvez in Pensacola. And again, like, that's part of the story of the American Revolution that I think sometimes gets left out. People mention the French helping, but it's like, no, the Spanish did quite a lot as well.
And that came after Benjamin Franklin met in secret with the Count of Aranda and convinced him that Spain needed to side with the Americans?
Yeah, I mean, the 18th century sometimes feels like just this constant movement of rivalry and alliances between, you know, the major powers in Europe. And these all play out overseas. I mean, not only in the Caribbean, but like in places like the Seven Years' War, it plays out in India, plays out all over the world. All of a sudden, you know, we're kind of seeing the beginning of that, of what we think of as a kind of globalized world. And in that theater of the Americas, yeah, I mean, you know, it makes sense from Franklin's press case that the British needs to be pushed out.
So Spain and France agreed that the British were the enemy.
At that particular juncture, yes. Because Britain had walked away from the Seven Years' War, having taken a lot of France's territory in Canada. You know, that's what I mean about the 18th century. It's just kind of, it feels like at times sort of endless combinations of alliances. But at that juncture, yeah, it was seen as advantageous to both to help, you know. But Spain was always slightly reluctant. And I mean, I think, you know, Aranda goes on to kind of write in some of his correspondence that, you know, he worries about where this is going to go. Because remember, this is still Spain that's very loyal to the idea of monarchy. And as you start to see, you know, you get the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, and all of a sudden, you know, the whole political system of Spain is under threat, just, you know, as it is in other places. But yeah, I mean, Spain does want to help, but they're also quite aware of the risks involved if this project takes off, if these colonists throw off the crown, you know, the British crown. So,
but as you pointed out, the Spanish governor in New Orleans, Bernardo de Galvez, sent 1,300 men to attack British outposts in West Florida.
Mm. And that was partly to do as well with unresolved issues with the British over Florida. But yeah, I mean, in fact, they, you know, they wanted to make sure that they got that territory back, because Florida had been ceded to the British. Britain had occupied Havana during the Seven Years' War, and so they swapped it for Florida to get Havana back, because it was a very important port. And so there was this ongoing rival, you know, anger about the whole thing, because they were completely caught, well, more or less caught off guard in Havana in 1762. So, yeah, so I mean, the American Revolution in some ways is also this opportunity for all these other issues to kind of be resolved on top of what was going on in the 13 colonies.
Did any, I'm using the word Hispanics, did any Hispanics living in the colonies fight on during the American Revolution?
I'm thinking that's harder to trace, I think, because I'm... You've caught me.
I know it wasn't in your book, but it occurred to me while I was reading your book.
Partly because of the way that people self-identified then too. You know, did people from the Spanish colonies? You mean like actively fight, like on the ground versus being in naval?
Join the George Washington's army.
Well, I know. I mean, I know. In fact, I was just reading today for a different project about a delegation of three people of color from Haiti who did. But I'm just trying to think, and I'm sure somebody's been going to ping me with an email going, you forgot about this battalion. But as far as I know, most of the assistance, certainly from the Spanish side, was much more naval than it was like, you know, actual foot soldiers.
One reviewer described your book as history as dialogue, and you include a lot of the writings of some of the most famous Spanish language writers writing about their encounters with the United States. They're not what I would have expected. We have Jose Marti, we have Carlos Fuentes, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, some less well-known writers, Domingo F. Sarmiento, well, Roberto Bolaño, who has recently experienced a major increase in interest, Carmen Bolosa, Cristina Rivera Garza. What do we learn from their writings about what we've been discussing?
I think what we learn is that the United States does cast quite a long shadow. And in some ways, there's kind of no understanding the world of Latin America without considering the United States. Like, these things cannot sort of be in vacuums. And I guess I'm reminded of the quip by the former Mexican president, Porfirio Diaz, who said, you know, poor Mexico, so far from God, so near to the United States. and I think there's... I think there's an element of that plays out in a literary sense because the U.S. because of the way the U.S. has engaged with these countries, but also because of the shared heritage. And I think the sense of shared heritage is far better known looking, I mean, this is why I kind of titled the book El Norte, looking up. I think, you know, if you are from northern Mexico, this isn't a forgotten history. You know these stories. And I think there's certainly a frustration with that, and that comes out in the literature as well. But also, it's symbiotic. You know, both sides need each other. And, you know, the Hispanic past is very much part of the present of the United States as well. And I think this is something that, you know, Rice's absolutely tried to grapple with.
Northern Mexico, to some degree, is largely influenced by the United States, for example. You're much more likely to find flour tortillas in the border towns than you are to find corn tortillas, which are the real thing. And there's been an awful lot of merging of cultures, and yet didn't the president say just the other day that our country is full?
Yes, well, he says lots of things.
Well, would he say that if somebody from Britain were coming to the United States to live?
I suspect not. I think this is this rhetoric is directed at not certain people, not all Hispanics, by the way, but certainly very, you know, largely. But, you know, there's so much about that even from just a very cold economic sense doesn't make any sense, right? I mean, Latin America as a bloc is an enormous trading partner. And just what you're saying about the flour tortillas, I mean, the amount of U.S. stuff that I see when I'm in places like the Dominican Republic Mexico has, you know, enormous Walmarts, and there's so much about its kind of commercial environment that is very similar to the United States. And again, like, you know, there's an economic connection overlaps as well.
Well, the economic, it was, the president had to back off on some of the things that he was calling for, because it was pointed out that it would be disastrous to many American businesses. There's an interrelationship here that, as you point out, goes back to before the Europeans, when the Europeans first arrive. But are we just totally ignoring it when we see it in terms of us against them?
It feels like it sometimes, you know. But when actually on the ground, you know, it is a different story, isn't it? I mean, you know. Like it or not, NAFTA's been one of the economic realities for a long time. So, you know, the things that we build, how they're built, cross the border. People's lives cross the border, you know. Culture crosses the border. I mean, you know, like, as we talked about earlier with things like tacos. So to say that America's fuller, to say that Hispanic culture is this other thing, does basically turned a blind eye to actually how people live their lives. And I think that's one of the really big disconnects that's causing, obviously, quite a big problem as well, is that, you know, we do have 500 years of this shared history. So we have connections in all kinds of ways. And certainly one of them is just that quotidian day-to-day way, you know, or people who just have to cross the border to work, or, you know, somebody who owns a business that gets one part from one side of the border and another part from the other side of the border. And, you know, and this plays out in multiple ways. And it's very complex. And it's something that a soundbite can't really sum up.
As we see when we look back at the Truman administration, as I understand, he was the first American president to ever go to Mexico. On the other hand, Puerto Rican independence movement led to an attempted assassination on him on November 1st, 1950. Is there still a movement for independence in Puerto Rico, especially in the light of the way the island has been treated recently?
The last vote that they had before the hurricane, I believe, was quite, not against, but the turnout was really low, and the number of people wanting independence was quite low. The struggle for Puerto Rican independence is quite a fascinating one. And the nice thing about working on El Norte is it gave me a bit more, I had a bit more space to explore it in a way that I didn't in Empire's Crossroads. But certainly, yeah, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you know, there was definitely, and obviously under Albizu Campos, who was one of the key leaders of independence, you know, there was quite a strong independence movement. It'll be, as the island kind of pulls back, you know, it's still in the stages of recovery as well. I'll be curious to see what the next few years bring, like if there's going to be a real resurgence in this. On the other hand, you know, we've seen with Puerto Rico, I think something like 300,000, 400,000 people have left the island now. So, you know, there's a real question mark over which way it's going to go in the future. But certainly, its internal debate about independence has, you know, absolutely had its own, you know, had violent moments. And I think there's been my impression is there's been a lot of, you know, disagreement, and lots of push and pull. But, you know, will the treatment of Puerto Ricans after Hurricane Maria be the straw that breaks the camel's back and really brings back the independence movement? Or will it be seen as, you know, statehood is the only way to actually guarantee that we'll get help when we need it? Like, being in this Commonwealth position right now, I think, is leaving a lot of people wondering if this is the most effective state to be in. So I think the next couple of years for Puerto Rico are going to be very, very crucial.
Just one more thing. One of the candidates for the Democratic nomination is a Mexican-American. Is this the first time that's happened?
Juan Castro? For president. Yeah, I believe
we've had
so.
We've had people in Congress.
Right. That's what I'm just, I'm, yeah, sorry. You're making, It's like I'm trying to pull up the Wikipedia of my brain very quickly. I believe so. And again, I think, you know, the U.S. is pretty overdue for some Hispanic representation at the very highest offices. I mean, obviously, president, that would be quite something. But certainly, you know, it wasn't that long ago that the Hispanic community started, getting good, you know, bigger numbers of members of the Senate and House. But even today, such as Ocasio-Cortez, you know, she gets an awful lot of flack. So I think, you know, while we're seeing more people come in, they're also put under an awful lot of criticism. So, will we see a Mexican-American or Cuban-American or Hispanic-American of any background president in the near future? I don't know, but it'll be interesting to see for sure.
El Norte is El Norte, the epic and forgotten story of Hispanic North America, is Carrie Gibson's latest book. It's from Atlantic Monthly Press, and it's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.